In my conversation with Claudia Zelovansky, she asks difficult questions. What happens when you get the thing that you really want and it still doesn't make you happy? Do art and theater, the very things that she has spent the majority of her life creating and thinking about and preparing for, do they really matter? How do you handle the shame of when your dreams and the things you believed in, you don't believe in anymore? I've known Claudia for over 20 years, and she has always been brave enough to face the tough questions, and she does so again here. Thank you, Claudia, for your continued courageousness. Hello, and welcome to another installment of At the Podium with me, Patrick Huey. At the Podium is a platform where we will learn from people who come from different walks of life, careers, and experiences, but all share one thing in common. They have stepped fully into the transformative power of saying yes to the unexpected turns of their lives, and they are now using the power of their voice, or podium, to make an impact on the world we live in today. At the Podium is the intersection of art, culture, and big thoughts wrapped up in good, old-fashioned conversation. Today, I'm thrilled and humbled to share the podium with Claudia Zelovansky. Claudia has over 15 years of experience as a theater administrator, professor, director, and coach. She holds a Bachelor of Science from Northwestern University in Performance Studies and a Master of Fine Arts in Directing from the Yale School of Drama. During the course of her career, Claudia has held administrative posts at numerous arts and culture organizations, including Manhattan Theater Club, Dallas Theater Center, and Martin Vinick Planning for the Arts, where she worked on a wide range of domestic and international museums, theaters, schools, and art districts to improve planning, programming, and overall solvency. She has taught acting and directing across the country and has mentored hundreds of students. As coach and founder of CZ Coaching, Claudia specializes in helping professionals of all kinds grow as presenters, speakers, and communicators as she continues to work with actors of all levels. Currently executive director of the Mercury Store, Claudia has the great pleasure and challenge of building an organization and a new model of artistic advancement from the ground up. Hello, Claudia. Welcome to At the Podium.
Hello. I feel like I need to edit that.
You've done so much and it's so rich. It's so varied. I love it. I wanted to talk to you because I wanted to hear about the Mercury Store and the work that you're doing there. What you guys are doing in Brooklyn is actually changing the face of how art is actually made. So I would love to for you to tell us what the Mercury Store is and how it all came into being.
Definitely. The Mercury Store is brand new, and it is the brainchild of a very close friend and colleague of mine, as well as of Patrick's from graduate school, our friend Will Frears. Will and I were in the same class of directors at Yale together, and we were inexplicably like siblings almost immediately. Will came up with this idea for the Mercury Store when he was experiencing, and I think he would use these words too, a kind of deep dissatisfaction with his own situation, his own work as a director. There's lots of things that are difficult about being a theater director, which we can certainly talk about. But in his particular case, he found himself with both the logistical challenges of being a parent and wanting to be home for his kids. Being a theater director tends to make you an itinerant worker. But I think even more so, he was looking for a way to do work that felt meaningful for the field. And so he started to consider, well, what if there was a place where directors could come or choreographers could come, just like there are places that writers go on retreat, like the McDowell Colony, places like that, where people go to work without the pressure of and the limitations of product. And so, as we always say with the Mercury Store, we've replaced the pressure of production with the pressure of excellence and innovation, in the sense that what we really are trying to do is figure out how to build an environment in which people are resourced in all the ways they need to be resourced, which means concrete resources, emotional resources in terms of support, and are encouraged and pushed to go as far as they can possibly go in their work. So the idea was Will's. He worked on it for many, many years before I was involved. And in fact, we were supposed to launch basically the week that we all went into shutdown for COVID. And we had our full season scheduled, contracted, planned, although nobody would have ever obviously picked that for any of us in any context. It's been a very interesting experience going through a year with the company without being able to activate some of the programs, most of the programs we were intending to do, because as the world has changed through COVID and as artists have been profoundly, maybe more than any other professional group, just, well, and restaurant workers probably too, just devastated by COVID, we've had to really, again, re-ask ourselves the question, how can we serve this community? What does the community need now that it needed a year ago? And what are the new things that it needs that it didn't need before?
So you're really disrupting a very established pedagogy and belief around how art is made, particularly theater, because you're in New York and dance and things of that nature. Talk to me about that concept and idea of disruption, and if you guys knew it was there from the beginning, and how the Academy is responding, because we were nurtured in the Academy, and two very successful people out of the Academy are saying there's a different way.
I do think it's disruptive. I think that even though it is a generous structure in that it's there to support artists and it's there to support them financially, and one of the things that was super important to Will from the get-go is that people got paid living wages no matter what, and all of these things that sometimes are very, very hard to come by in the arts, even at a very high level, it is disruptive because it sort of names this thing that you're not really supposed to name, which is that the theater isn't working. And I'll be honest with you, Patrick, you know this, but I'll, for the audience, you know, just to share in the interest of full disclosure, the idea for the Mercury Store came from Will's discontent. My decision to come on board when he offered me the opportunity, which was obviously I was super honored, also came out of a deep, deep sense of conflict and frustration around the field. So I would probably describe the types of our discontentment and the nature of it as being different, but ultimately we were both driven to this opportunity out of a kind of discord, out of a kind of disruption that we were looking for. The Mercury Store doesn't need to exist if everything's hunky-dory, right? If artists are getting the developmental support that they need, if directors have enough time to direct plays, if there's enough money to pay people so that they don't have to be literally working 7 days a week so that they're not in financial duress all the time, the Mercury Store would be nice, but it's not necessary. But in fact, what we know is that not only is it necessary in those ways, but also that the way that things are done, like you're saying, like in the Academy and in the like establishment, are these kind of hamster wheels of ways of working. So like, even though you're there to do something artistic and creative, which often by its nature has sort of elliptical patterns as opposed to straight lines, you're supposed to be in rehearsal for 4 weeks. You're supposed to be in tech for 1 week. You're supposed to, you know, you go in these very prescribed ways. And it does not make most of the time for great work because it doesn't allow for any flexibility. That's not one person's fault. That's not the Academy's fault. That's not the establishment's fault. It's a very complex result, or the result of a very complex series of obstacles that the arts always face, which is like financial, like lack of finances, being a culture that's always relied on patronage, on financial support. It's, you know, every museum in the world, you know, is buoyed by financial support. There are all of these reasons that the structures have become super, super tight, but they really aren't working. they're not working to create opportunities for the artists to get better and stronger and push the envelope. And they're also not, they're not creating new models for work because they're just too restrictive. So I do think that the Mercury Store is a disruptor because it stands, it's standing up and saying no. And it's also hopefully, even though not every organization will be able to do this, it's also saying like treating people with decency, paying them the way that they deserve to be paid, giving them the time off that they need, hopefully down the line, being able to offer health insurance. We have it as staff, but to artists that are coming in, like thinking about deep, like holistic health as a route to making good work is really at the center of what the Mercury Store is about. So I do think of it as disruptive. And I think Will feels, and I certainly am way on board for this, he is hoping that that as we grow and as we are more established in the field, that we develop a certain amount of muscle in the field that would enable us, for example, to go to the unions, the actors union, the directors union, et cetera, and be like, we need to talk about how to make some changes here. Like, your people are not getting what they need. So there's a bunch of different ways in which we're thinking about how we can be hopefully disruptive in the field. But I think honestly, the last thing I'll say about it, and then is that content has not been able to be first in a very long time. Mm. I don't live in a dream world. I know that there are will always be other factors in the market, and there should be. We have to live in reality, but the Mercury Store is an opportunity to put content first in a way that just has not been possible for a long time.
I think something that you said that's really profound to me is that the birth of the Mercury Store was born out of a discordant feeling that you, that Will have had as it relates to how we make art. You've had a very spectacular career as a theater director. You were part of an excellent graduating class of directors who've done amazing things in their lives. And part of what we talk about here at the podium are people like yourself who were on a very clear trajectory, which when we're shot out of the Yale School of Drama, you're shot in a very clear direction. And at a certain point, you said, I'm going to go in a different direction. What caused that transition or that discordant feeling? And how did you reconcile that in your mind in terms of, I've been prepped, trained my entire life to do this, and now I'm going to go. And you're still within the conversation. You haven't left the conversation. But how you're interacting with it has completely shifted.
Totally. First of all, I want to say I really appreciate that question because it's easy to look at somebody else's life or to think backwards sometimes to your own life and think, oh, well, of course, A led to B led to C. But in fact, in the moment for me, it was an extremely difficult process. It was a very painful process. And also, I think it was, even though in the end there was a kind of catalytic break, which I'll tell you about, I think it was a long time coming too. I think the simplest way I can say it is that after we finished at Yale, I had an opportunity, which was a great, great, great opportunity to go to Dallas to be the associate artistic director at Dallas Theater Center, which is like the big regional theater there, the big like flagship theater. It was a great experience for me. Loved my job, learned a tremendous amount, and realized that one of the logical routes that I could go professionally was to become an artistic director. And for those of you guys who don't work in the theater, those are not always filled, but often filled by directors who both lead the artistic practice and vision for the institution, but they also direct plays. And I knew that that was something that was possible for me. And I had a couple of bites on things while I was in Dallas, and all of them were in very far away or odd places like Alaska. There's a really cool theater in Alaska. And I didn't know at the time whether it was not right for me because it was always going to be not right for me, or if because I had just lived in Dallas for 3 years and it was right after 9/11. And I just felt like maybe I didn't want to be that far from the places that I had grown up. But I knew at that moment, at least, that I didn't feel that I could go that path. So I asked myself, okay, what are some other versions of being a director that might be better for me? And I thought, well, I love teaching. I've just started teaching. Maybe being a professor in addition to being a director is the right thing. And I ended up going to Oberlin, which I loved, and teaching. I absolutely fell in love with teaching, especially at the college and graduate level. And then I realized that if I was going to be a full-time professor, probably I was going to also have to live somewhere, at least to start, very unusual. And I don't want to sound provincial because I actually love living other places. But in both cases, I sort of gathered a certain amount of information and it was almost right, but it didn't, but something was a little bit strange. Went back to New York, which is also where I'm from. And for the first time in my life, I lived a life just totally as a freelance director. And I was also teaching on the side. It went well, and I was so unhappy. At that point, I had tried a bunch of different ways to imagine putting it together, putting a life together for me as a director that would be okay for me, you know, whether it was the artistic director route or the academic route, or in this case, the like, I'm just a director and everything else comes second to that route. And I realized if things had been going horribly and I was sad or depressed or worried all the time or whatever, that would make sense. But when things are going well and I'm still struggling so much and I know I'm unhappy, I have to face it. Something is wrong. And I spent a year struggling mostly internally. I was very ashamed, I think, in certain ways of talking about it because so many of my peers were in the theater. And I think I was afraid to tell people, but also I didn't want my discontent to infect them. I didn't want them to feel like it was a value judgment. I just didn't know quite how to talk about it. All I ultimately realized was that I wasn't sure, and it's really upsetting, but I wasn't sure if I believed anymore. The thing is about the theater, or about all art forms, I'm guessing, and Patrick, I think you can relate to this, you have to believe. And I don't mean you have to believe like in some formal way, but it's a job that requires so much of you. It usually doesn't have the monetary rewards of more traditional career paths. So belief is part of what supports you. It's part of what buoys you. And I thought, oh God, like if the metaphor that kept coming to my mind was, if I were married, I would to the theater, which I basically was, I would say like, I don't think I'm in love anymore. I didn't know what to do, but I knew I needed to do something. I had this feeling that I didn't want to leave the cultural sector. I wanted to stay in the art sector, but I just didn't know what it was. I just felt like I had to do something. And I'll just say this very briefly, that I started to look at opportunities that were in the cultural sector, but they were like working for the National Endowment for the Arts, or working at, like, I started to look into the policy side. I wasn't sure. And my sister, who is a very wise woman, she said to me, you should just look and see if there are any graduate programs that do like art policy or art management. And I was like, I have been to graduate school. I went to a very good graduate school for which I'm still paying loans. She was like, just look, because maybe. She just kept pushing. And Columbia University had a program. And I said, well, I'm going to apply, but I'm not going. And I applied and I got in and I was like, I got in, but I'm not going. And she was like, you need to shake up your gratitude a little bit there. But anyway, the very short version is that I finally made a promise to myself that if I didn't have a good opportunity by the end of August, I would go. That basically I was like, I don't want to be in purgatory forever. And that's what happened. I had a couple of interesting leads on things. They didn't pan out. And so I committed to the promise I had made to myself. I started this program at Columbia and it changed everything for me. It did change things for me in a functional, concrete way, which is that I met a professor who became my next boss. So that's like a very concrete thing, huge. But you know what else it did? It gave me my mojo back. Because all of a sudden, having gone through this terribly difficult, mostly internal year where I just felt crappy a lot of the time and I felt disconnected from my world, all of a sudden I was back in school and I was like, oh my God, if I work really hard, I'm going to get all A's and I'm going to learn all these things. And all of a sudden being inside of a meritocracy again, being inside of a system that if you really did your best and you worked really hard, you were going to get rewarded for it, was extremely healing. And then, of course, I also learned a lot. So I did not end up finishing that program. I just started it and I met my future boss. But that was really what the pivot was like.
I want to talk to you, and you know Regina Bain. Mm-hmm. She, like yourself, had that moment where you have to think, is what I'm doing, not what I'm supposed to be doing, but is it filling the thing within me that I need to have filled? And that led her down a path to where she is today at the Louis Armstrong House. Mm-hmm. I have talked a lot about this idea of shame. When you come out of programs like Yale, NYU, there is an expectation, implicit and explicit, in what you will be doing and how your life will go. As you start moving away from that paradigm, there is a lot of shame tied to, I'm turning my back on this thing that I'm supposed to be doing. Have I, and the shame is related to failure. Have I failed? At least for me, it was. And I think part of being able to make that shift that you have to make is that you have to get right with your own idea of shame and what that looks like. That's the piece holding so many people back. We live so much of our life in shame about our weight, about our sexuality, and all those things are just straw horses that need to be knocked down. So I love that you talk about that idea of shame, sort of how do you move past that into action?
I felt shame about not wanting to do it anymore. Right. About realizing it was not right for me. And as you said, I even used to describe it that year when I was trying to process everything and figure out the next step. I used to describe it as being in the closet because I really felt like I could not come out in certain ways because I think of the shame that you're describing. And then I also think, Patrick, that even though being at Columbia really revitalized me in certain ways and gave me a way to move forward, it's the shame stuck around as I moved into my new position. Then the shame became interestingly less externalized, less about like, I wonder what so-and-so thinks or did I mess up, and more internal in that when I was working for Martin Vinick Planning for the Arts, which was a really interesting job, and Martin Vinick is a remarkable and very decent man. So I felt incredibly lucky to be working there. I also sort of knew that it wasn't quite the right. I knew that it was like the right next thing, but I knew it wasn't where I was headed, but I didn't know where I was headed. And I would definitely have these moments where I would think, have I just blown it? Should I have just cared less about financial security? Should I have just had a stronger stomach for constantly looking for work? Whatever the things are that the theater demands of you. I definitely still really wrestled with a fear, which I think resonates for me with what you're saying, of wasting the opportunity that had been given to me. Mm. There was shame around what will people think? Am I a failure? All the stuff you're definitely saying. And then there was shame that was just about having had the great privilege of telling stories in the theater, like learning with very gifted people how to make work and tell stories, having been given that opportunity, it was hard to reconcile that with a sort of more regular life in a certain way.
People often ask, what was life like going to Yale? People want that window into that. And I do think that process that you just described of creating story and creating art with phenomenally talented people, gifted people. That was the piece that I had to reconcile, was letting that go. Because in the pedestrian movement of life, you don't run into that level of engagement. And it's by design you don't do that. By design, you don't get to step out of life for 3 years and just go do something like that that's so specific and so concentrated. So I think that's part of the grieving process, I think, when people have to say yes to something new, is that all those things that were familiar and tactile to you, they don't vanish or diminish, but the place they have in your life must shift to create new space for something new to come in, which can be equally as glorious, beautiful, et cetera, but it's different.
And I agree with you. You know, it's so funny. I have found in my life that people often do ask me about Yale, and that in the theater, people have very strong feelings about it, positive and negative. Like it's like a lightning rod or whatever. But in fact, it's not really a lightning rod. It's just a school that happens because of its history and commitment to be able to gather people who are very, very unusual to be able to do creative work together. And I have the same experience as you, Patrick. It was just an enormous blessing for me, even though we were always stressed out and exhausted and like tired and mad and all that stuff, because we worked very, very hard there. I remember even thinking way before I had my moment of crisis, my crisis point, I remember even thinking a year or so after we left, oh, that's never going to happen again. I do remember having that thought that it was, and I want to say this just for context for anybody who, for whom this is not the world that they typically have occupied or whatever, which is that this is true in lots of fields, I know, but so I'll just share about it for the theater, which is that the theater is a field where the people who practice within it, the actors, the directors, the designers, the writers, the technical directors, et cetera, they spend a lot of time looking for work. And I don't just mean that there's a lot of unemployment, which there is, but I mean that specifically, if you sign on to be an actor or you sign on to be a director, in my case, what you realize once you're professionalized is that you're going to actually have to spend like 50% of your time trying to get work. And for some of our colleagues, that was a bargain that was really okay for them. Doesn't mean they liked it. Doesn't mean that that was the part that they enjoyed. For some of them, it was. But that piece of the puzzle was fine. For me, the less time that I got to spend working, like doing the thing, and the more time that I had to spend trying to do the thing, the harder it was to stay.
It becomes, what are your non-negotiables?
That's right. And everybody's are different. And one thing that I always say to young artists that I have taught or that I'm working with is, do not be ashamed of the things you need. The straighter you can get, the clearer you can get about the things you need and the less judgmental you can be about them, the happier you will be. But knowing your non-negotiables, to use your phrase, and being willing and accepting them is everything.
You come from a family of artists. It's in your DNA. How did that DNA support and buoy you and guide some of the choices that you've made in your life?
The number one thing is, I can't ever underestimate the fact that I lived in a world in which my home was filled with art and ideas, and that it was completely normal to be working on things and thinking about things. And even, you know, my dad had a studio, like a small room that was his studio in our apartment that we lived in for most of my childhood, like from the time that I was 9 until I went to college. You know, it was when we were little, my mom said we would come home after school or whatever, and we would sit and draw on the floor of my dad's studio while he was working on something or whatever. So it just was normalized for me and for Nora, my sister, in a way that no doubt made a really big difference. And there continues to be, in a way that sometimes we even make fun of me and Nora, a profound emphasis on the world of arts and ideas and like, what are you working on? What are you making? Not the career side of it, but really the like, what is the thing you're doing? What are you making? What are you thinking about? So I know that I definitely grew up feeling like that was normal and that I should be thinking about what I was making all the time or whatever. And neither of my parents were interested in the theater. So maybe it was a space that was available. I definitely think I understood, because of my parents, there was very little fantasy attached to the arts for me because of having grown up in it. And because, like, I think that maybe even some of my anxieties that did surface ultimately that made me feel like it might not be the right situation for me. There was never a point at which I had a kind of like dream idea of it, because I just lived in a place where people were in it all the time. The only other thing I guess I would say is that another really big blessing from growing up in my house was that if you had something that you were working on or an idea, there were always people to knock it around with you. And my parents always took us very seriously. There was so much emphasis on intense intellectual productivity. But I think like for my parents, making art in both my parents' case, they exist in the visual art sector primarily. My dad also in the performing arts. That was just a very normalized way of thinking about what you do. It had and continues to have a huge impact on me. I think probably other than their intellectual and creative support, the fact that it wasn't sugar-coated, there was no capacity for it to be a fantasy, probably. You see me hesitating. I think it primarily helped me, but that's also, you know, maybe people are sometimes a little bit buoyed by fantasy. Maybe it carries them along through hard times. For me, that was not really an option.
It posits the question about the idea of environment and what is normalized for you, and how do you process that, and how do you express that as you continue to grow and develop from that starting point. I'm always curious to know how that environment that what we grew up in impacts what we do today, even if it's a reaction not to that. Mm-hmm. I have one last question for you. How are the arts saving this moment that we are in?
You want me to give you the like straight shot?
Listen, you're currently at the podium.
So. I'm at the podium. I think that one of the things we're thinking about a lot at the Mercury Store right now is how to respond to and support artists who are going to be coming, as we all are, re-entering a different world, and not just a different world functionally, definitely functionally, but a different world in terms of global psychic energy. Like we have all been altered, and how we've been altered and how that has made us stronger and how that has made us more fragile and all those things is not predictable. It's not something that you can anticipate except to know it's going to happen, right? You don't know what it is. You just know that it will be, right? I always think and say a lot at work, and it's probably the way that I'm most disruptive, to use the word that you asked me about at the beginning. I always feel that the biggest service that the Mercury Store can pay to our community is to insist upon always asking the question, is the art important? Does it actually matter? Is this providing something? Not because I expect a lot of, no, it isn't. No, it's, not because I expect necessarily that much negative in response to that, but because I think it's important for us to be brave enough to consider that question. And for a year in which we were all in our own ways, emotionally and also concretely, laid bare and forced into a scenario in which we were literally food, shelter, safety, protection, I can say that I know that for me and many people, certainly one thing that the arts, I think, provided for lots and lots of people during this space of being really in the inside, like being really in the inside of the COVID sort of like trap. I think the arts probably provided for many people in the form of music, in the form of both played like Patrick and listened to, and in the form of movies and television and all that stuff, a way to escape in a very healthy way, a way to imagine the before, a way to imagine the after, a way to get out of the headspace that we were in. They know just from how much people use those services that really made a difference. And I will say to you that I think that to your question, the question of how the theater, or forget the theater even, but the arts support us moving forward is very open-ended. And I know that they will, and I know that they're essential, but I don't know what that looks like yet. And I want the Mercury Store to have the courage of our convictions in allowing it to reveal itself and meeting it, as opposed to just being like, well, we're just going to start doing plays again. Right? I want to be bold enough or disruptive enough to say, well, here we are. what do people need? What are people looking for? Do people just need to gather? Do they need to hear a story that they've heard before? Do they need to hear a story they've never heard before? So I feel like the arts really provided a balm for people. And I know they did for you, Patrick, and they certainly did for me over the year. And the future is unwritten in this regard. And maybe the deep disruption of this year, as scary as it is, will provide an opportunity to shake off old expectations.
You struck a chord in me when you asked the question, is it relevant? Because the arts tend to lead the way for the rest of the world. I believe the more that the arts can open its arms to reflect the moment and the time that we're in, it can only accrue to the benefit of the world.
I was saying to Will, my colleague, our friend, all these artists are going to come in and they're all going to have had a year inside and they're all going to have a lot to work out. And we should encourage everybody to give themselves the space to work it out, to shake it off, and then make something, as opposed to shaking it off into something. Because I think there's layers to get through before the event is here. And I want to, can I say one last thing? Is that okay? All right. I want to say, you know how we were talking about how when you make the transition from one way of thinking your life is going to go into another and you carry certain things about what you loved about the first thing into the next thing, but some things go away and all that stuff. In the last couple of months, I started to learn everything that I could about the New York City and New York State vaccination structure to help people get vaccination appointments. And the reason why I did that is because when my parents were eligible, I was obsessed. I was like, they will be getting vaccinated immediately. And I went crazy. I was a crazy person. Learned the whole system and I spent 14 hours on it and I got them appointments and I got them vaccinated. And then I just had this moment where I thought, like, this is a crazy Byzantine system. People must need help. And so for the last 3 months, I've been volunteering on various sites, booking people, mostly seniors or people who are not tech savvy or whatever. And the reason why I mention it is because it reminds me of the theater in one very particular way. Like, it hits a spot that for me, I guess, always wants to get hit, which is connection. So I don't know these people. Most of them, I don't even know what they look like, but I communicate with them. Sometimes it's over email, sometimes on the phone. They're giving me these pieces of information about their lives. I'm taking them. I'm trying to find them something that works for them. I'm bringing it back to them. But mostly what we're having is this kind of very abbreviated, but very intense human connection. And I realize that that's partially why I keep doing it, because it makes me, it simulates that same experience of connecting.
Gosh. Claudia, thank you so much. Thank you so much for your time today and your willingness to share your voice and your wisdom with us. I am beyond grateful that you joined us here at the podium. To those of you who are watching, remember, we all have a voice, so use yours wisely.